Blog Talk Radio.
The moment.
You go busting your fist against a stone wall. You're not using your brain. That's what the white man wants you to do. Look at you. What makes you ashamed of being black?
Number love for you. I even know how hard it is. No doubt. Being a woman, a black woman at that. In this white man's world, sometimes we overlook the fact that we can ride hard in our fist. We don't be knowing the pain we be causing. This white man's world. White man's world. I ain't saying I'm innocent at all. I'm just saying it's white man's world. It's all, yeah. For all those times that I messed up, or we messed up.
Dear sister, got me twisted up in prison. I miss you. Crying, looking at my nieces and my nephews. They say don't let this cool world get you. Kind of suspicious, swearing one day you might leave me for somebody that's richer. Twist the cap off the bottom. I take a sip and see tomorrow. Gotta make it if I have to beg a bottle. Down and quiet. Your brothers don't receive they mail. Best believe we ride. Eating Jack Matt, staring at the walls. Inside the sausage cage, where they captured all my ways and bonds. In time I learned a few lessons. Never fall for riches. Apologies to my true sisters. Far from bitches. Help me raise my black nation. Reparations to do. It's true. Caught up in this world, I took advantage of you. Tell the babies how I love them. Precious boys and girls. Born black in this white man's world. And all I heard was,
ah,
My youth and youth, they have a plan, and I have a mission. I make sure who no firm in a the Armageddon. So when you come, become a man, him know that where you stand. Him know him poop and set it, so him follow tradition. If Marcus can be set be read, then welcome and I pray. Can knowledge and the key, and it's me set the people free. And I lay a philosophy, it's African unity. Who no watch a segregation and social impurity. The rest is not just for the swift, but those who can endure. Make sure you have a steady footing in a Zion door, and keep your thoughts secure. The love is for the poor, but some little boy have bought some gun. Them mumma can't afford. If just a blood will run, the danger will be done. The heaven and the earth will pass away before him word will come. But if it finds it out a cause, there will be no reward. For you to enter Zion gates, because you are a fraud.
For the youth in the struggle, fighting guerrilla warfare. Ah, ah, hey. Somalia to Ethiopia, from Egypt to Zimbabwe. Ah, ah,
hey. I listen as they say a war. If color is a scar, if one from every nation can come live up on a par. So don't care who you are, there's a brighter morning star. It's shining, wake the town and tell the people near and far. You seek and you will search, with science and research. The flesh it is the temple and the temple is the church. I listen as it's every work, so awesome and alert. Don't fix up on them corners, I like rubbish sheep and dirt. I listen as it's say a one, respect for every man. Look here the race, look here the color, not the religion. So make a decision, be born the division. Cause each and every race I use to chat for the nation.
From Portmore to Kingston, from Kingston to Mantico Bay. Ah, ah. Seaview to Riverton, come on 100 Parkland. From Jungle to Ream, from Tevele to Matthews Lane. Outside to Tel Aviv, from Iraq to USA.
I got loyalty, got royalty inside my DNA. Cocaine quarter piece, got war and peace inside my DNA. I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. I got hustle, though, ambition, flow inside my DNA. I was born like this, and sworn like this, immaculate conception. I transform like this, perform like this, which yells you a new weapon. I don't contemplate, I meditate, then off your fucking head. This that puts the kids to bed, this that I got realness. I just kill shit cause it's in my DNA. I got millions, I got riches building in my DNA. I got dark, I got evil that rot inside my DNA. I got off, I got trouble, some heart inside my DNA. I just win again, then win again like Wimbledon I serve. Yeah, that's him again, the sound that engine in is like a bird. You see fireworks and Corvette tire skirt the boulevard. I know how you work, I know just who you are. See, use a bitch, your hormones probably switch inside your DNA. All that sucker shit inside your DNA. Daddy probably snitch, heritage inside your DNA. Backbone don't exist, burn on side a jellyfish I gauge. See my pedigree, most definitely don't tolerate the front. Shit I been through probably offend you, this is Parler's oldest son. I know murder, conviction, burners, boosters, burglars, ballers, dead. Redemption scholars, fathers dead, with kids and I wish I was fed. Forgiveness, yeah. Soldier's DNA, born inside the beast. My expertise check out in second grade. When I was 9, on sale motel, we didn't have nowhere to stay. At 29, I've been so well, hit cartwheel in my estate. And I'm gon' shine like I'm supposed to. Antisocial extrovert, and excellent mean an extrovert. And absentness, what the fuck you hurt? And passiveness never struck my nerve. And that's a rip, gonna plead this case. The reason my power's here on earth, salute the truth and the prophecy. I got loyalty, got royalty. royalty inside my DNA.
Successful, or they might fail, but it will depend upon the attitude and the kind of language that Richard Nixon will use. Certainly, he cannot be trigger happy as he was in Attica, because the Chinese people are strong people, and their land is very fertile. We know that the ruling circle in this country will only take advantage of victims, such as the prisoners at Attica, the guards at Attica, and the Vietnamese people and black people in this country, as well as poor white people.
The party is at this time engaged in a struggle of gaining representation in the institutions in our community. And according to our 10-point program, this was always our fight. We've been misrepresented by the press for a long time, but the truth always finds its way out. And I think that history will justify our past actions, and certainly history condemns things and people by eliminating them. The party is still very much alive and kicking, and I think we must have done something right. We plan to use whatever means that's effective and sufficient in order to gain our desires. We're not, of course, we can't be serious about the law of this country if the country itself is not serious about it. I think first we have to make them serious about the law, and many of the laws that they're serious about are bad laws, and we have to change those. But we're not going to, I don't think it should be required of us to limit our activities within certain behaviors prescribed by this corrupt system. I think we'll use the most appropriate approach to the resolution of the contradiction that's here in the United States. Well, in the first place, that I have absolutely no power as an individual. The power is with the people. So the real question is that what are the people going to do? I said we're going to unite and become very strong, and we're going to free all political prisoners and prisoners of war. We'll free the Soledad Brothers Three. That's Cliche, Drumgo, Fleeter Drumgo, and George Jackson. And all of the other brothers there at Soledad and white prisoners also have a case, because the prisons are not rehabilitation centers. They are no more than concentration camps. I plan to visit Bobby Seale, the chairman, and
right.
All of our party members who are in prison, and also many other political prisoners and prisoners of war. I think that includes everyone who's in prison. I would like to visit them. In the people's interest, because as I said before, that individually we're so weak until it is a strategic mistake to view ourselves as one person. We must view ourselves because the oppressor is living in an illusion in the first place, and he wants to deny the reality of death. So when, after all, the people are the writers of all world history, are the makers of all world history, and without the people, there's nothing. So the central problem and the central issue is...
The
possibility that bail may be revoked. Could you give us a statement now?
I'm not going to say anything until after.
My treatment was generally abusive and oppressive, and primarily because of the fact that I was a prisoner of war and a political prisoner.
What do you think is going to happen with the Black Panthers now? You're losing your leaders, etc.
It is true that many of our leaders have been confined in the concentration camps here in America. I know that the Black Panther Party will prevail. It's the vanguard of the people's struggle, and that while leaders are put into prison, new leaders are born, new leaders are made.
Black Power, Black Power, Black Nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, the People's Political Party National Chairman Matt Turner, and co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland. Call in each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time. Call in number is 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic is going to be, what's the totality of black power? We're going to open up the lines for our host, People's Political Party National Chair, Matt Turner. Black power. Can you hear me, Tim and Matt?
Black power. Yeah, right on. Black power, brother. Yeah, man, you know, again, you want to welcome, you know, listeners, however they're listening, you know, to In Defense of the People Radio. We're a new... you know, children on the block, so to speak, you know. But as we go, you know, we expand and till it become full blown, you know what I'm saying? But the back topic is not, you know, necessarily a new topic or something that all of a sudden, you know, we just thought about. It's more like a reiteration of what black power is. You know, putting it into perspective, what does it mean, what does it stand for, what does it equate to as far as, you know, being on this side of the world, here in the hells of America, specifically, because of the conditions that black people find themselves in, very crucial times that we live in today. You know, so we just wanted to, you know, go back over, you know, black power in its totality. Maybe a particular spin that we could be infusing here. But wanted to basically, you know, just deal with five things, you know, right out of the gate necessarily. That is, you know, very... crucial and critical to understanding you know, the topic, you know, the totality of black power. And basically, those things, five, spirituality, you know, politically, historically, culturally, and militarily. Black power, by definition, is black people being in control of their own destiny, determining which path or how are we going to conduct ourselves under or this system or in a jurisdiction such as America, dealing with the various different groups and what that power means for black people specifically. You know, it's something, you know, that arrived, that derived from some brothers being in the South, in the rural South, trying to organize black people to the point where black people could get some representation in the political system of America, whether locally, statewide, or federally, because black people had been paying taxes to Caesar, while at the same time not having any representation. And so this is one of the slogans that came out of that, where it said taxation without representation. And so, again, you know, some brothers and sisters who cared about the welfare of black people on the heels of so-called Reconstruction, that's coming out of what we understand politically correct as physical slavery. The abolition of physical slavery in the 1860s. And so this supposedly era of what's called Reconstruction. And we understand, those of us who are conscious enough politically, to know that Reconstruction was just that, a reconstructing, reconstructing of the system, the state, in its capitalist ways, raw and naked capitalism, in other disguises or forms, to keep perpetuating itself. In the meantime, the people were being told that America is reconstructing itself off of the hill, on the hills of slavery, as though the so-called former slaves would be cut in a piece of the pie. These amendments that had been passed, you know, the 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, whatever you want to call it, and which was supposed to give black people these inalienable rights to be immune to discrimination. And so the state, as a sinister as it is, as it's cutthroat, as it has always been, has learned to keep constantly morphing itself into you know, like a chameleon does. When the chameleon comes under attack, if it's on a tree, and you know, if a chameleon comes under attack, let's say by, you know, a larger creature, of course, than itself, such as, for instance, a snake, the chameleon senses that snake's approach, and that chameleon, whatever it is up against, or whatever it is, you know, next to, or you know, for movement, it morphs itself into the color at which it is nearest. For instance, if that chameleon is in the tree and the snake is coming from above, slithering from above, then the chameleon, once it picks up that snake, the chameleon, through this transfiguration, metamorphic transfiguration, morphs into the color of the tree, brown. And so that snake cannot pick that chameleon up. So in essence, this is what the state has done. The state has morphed itself out of slavery in the Reconstruction and out of Reconstruction into Jim Crow and out of Jim Crow into the 70s and 80s and the 90s into something else. And, of course, today in the so-called, what is it, the 21st century now, you know, morphed itself into another being, another entity, and you keep constantly perpetuating itself. And so I say all that to say this, as the state keeps, you know, switching up his game, that black people have to be forced to make these moves too in order to keep constantly staying alive, keep constantly surviving, keep constantly finding ways to live, you know, to make ends meet or to stay above the water, you know. And so we realize that the most practical sense is in the people having the power, and particularly black people in this case. And of course, there are, you know, other groups, so-called minority groups in this country. We say brown power to brown people, red power to red people, even yellow power to yellow people, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, those of us who understood that, you know, that white power was understood, because white people don't have to say white power. Only those who are out on the front, who are out in the open, who were used as pawns to say white power, recognizing these various, you know, neo-Nazi groups or organizations that, you know, that's typical of America, you know what I'm saying? So it is necessary that black people have to have power, contrary to all the talking heads, the New Age ideological framework that doesn't conclude in trying to reach conclusion as to the problems that black people have and how to solve them. And so we understand, again, that that problem has to be solved by the people, you know, taking that power into their own hands in order to be in control of their own destiny. With black people, you know, of course, yeah, you know, to control one's destiny, you know, the one thing that black power can establish or reestablish is a reclamation of some sense of self, you know, black pride, you know, the different forms of self, you know, self-worth, you know. And so when we say black power, and I know we mean black love, you know, which is as natural as nature going to get. And it is very practical and reasonable for black people to have black power. You can take other groups that have went through these cataclysms, similar cataclysms under the system capitalism, white supremacy, you know, white world supremacy, the Eurocentric view of the world, the Eurocentric domination of the planet, whose majority of people is black and brown people, indigenous black and brown people. For instance, when the Arab-speaking people or the Arabic-speaking people, the so-called Arabs of the so-called Near East, or this land has been carved out as the Middle East, when the Europeans came in the late 19th century, in their expansionist era, in their expansionist ambitions, their international interests, because of their material consumption of natural resources, once the Arab people, you know, began to realize that the natural resources, in this case, the oil that was underneath their feet, that was indigenous or native to their land, you know, began to be such a precious commodity because of the way that the Europeans were designing their so-called civilization and their material civilization. And so once the Arab people, after a few ticks, began to realize the exploitative ways of the Europeans, and that there was really no genuine humanitarian relationship or a genuine humanism from one man to the next, it forced the Arabic-speaking people to do what a turtle does, in a sense. When a turtle, again, you know, a turtle could be used as another example. When a danger arrives, a turtle, what does it do? It, you know, it shoots back into its shell to protect itself, you see. And so the Arabic-speaking people, they began to understand that this relationship that they were having would slowly but surely grow into a master-slave relationship, the predator and the prey, you know, the exploiter and the exploited. So this is what forced the Arabic-speaking people to start developing a sense of nationalism, you know, and it was only natural that they did. And so hence the rise of Arab nationalism in response to European imperialism. And as a result of that relationship, the Arabic-speaking people obviously developed attitudes, a particular type of attitude that we hear in parts, you know, the country or what we say in the South, you know, referred to as swag, you see. And so the Arabic-speaking people began to develop a type of attitude that was shaped into an ideology, you know, which was Arab nationalism. And Arab nationalism was as the same result, or was to achieve the same goal, where the Arabic-speaking people who had begun to succumb to white world supremacy, the European or Eurocentric view of the world in terms of international politics, you know, the consumption of oil and how this relationship was going to go between the Arabs and the Anglo-American establishment. The Anglo-American establishment is to be defined as the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant group who are also referred to as the British, you know, the Brits, you know, whose capital, economic capital, is London, okay? And so, and of course, we know what American is, of course, the Anglo-American establishment. And this is a combination of forces that, you know, congealed together, that consolidated their thought process or their ambitions to go around the earth raping other nations of their material resources. And so as the Arabs began to develop this nationalism, they began to develop, you know, a type of resistance. And this resistance was met with brutal force, you see. In some cases where the Arab people had practiced what is referred to as the democratic process or whatever, or the choosing of their leaders, many occasions the international arm of the state, known as the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, they went to work. And they would create one coup after the next. And these coups were based on whether or not this president or what have you, Shah or what have you in the Arabic-speaking language, whether or not he would acquiesce to the whims of the corporations, to the whims, in this case, of the Rockefeller clans, oil conglomerate cartels, you know, which are now known as Exxon, Mobil, on an international scale, such as BP, British Petroleum, you see, because the Brits were there first. See? And so this is what gave rise and gave birth to Arab nationalism, you see. And so that's a clear example, because they felt that it had to be some type of nationalism that had to be reinforced or, you know, updated, so to speak, you know, enhanced, or whatever you want to call it. You see, another example, we talk about nationalism, we can compare even a group of whites, okay? In this case, the Irish people, or the Irish people of that culture, Irish-speaking people, you know, who had their annual parades and celebrations on St. Patrick's Day in certain parts of the world of America. And so due to their antagonistic relationship with the British, which was based on what we can refer to as a religious confrontation, where it was the Catholics being persecuted by the Protestants. And so as a result of that, a British imperialism right next door. If you get a map and look at, you know, what is known as Greater Britain, you'll see these islands and these little, you know, places, you know, such as Scotland and Ireland, you know. And so that part of the what is known as Greater Britain came under the rule, a dominance of the British crown, the king and the queen. And so that developed the antagonistic relationship between the Irish and the Brits. And so what did it do? It forced the Irish to embrace a form of nationalism that would do what? That would protect their interests. You know, that would look out for them. That would make sure that the Irish people as a collective unit would be all right. That they would be able to live like they once were able to live, that they knew formerly before the Brits came in and started telling them what to do, dominating them on these different levels, in particularly economically, politically, you see. And so for a thousand years, you know, for hundreds of years, you know, the Irish, you know, had struggled with the British, you know, to win their humanity back, to win their, feelings of self back, so they can again determine their own destiny. You see what I'm saying? And so as a result of that, it was, in a sense, a relationship that had turned violent. And what grew out of the Irish attitude towards the British was the Irish Republican Army. And as a result of that, those who were trying to come out from under the yoke of the British, one white group dominating another white group, the Irish in turn began to be labeled as terrorists. And if you look at the situation, you go back to this Arab thing, you see the same phenomenon, where the Arabic-speaking people are now the terrorists as a result of the imperial ambitions of the Anglo-American establishment. You see, and so these things naturally happen when one group wants to dictate the lifestyle and ways of another group, then you naturally have conflict. You see, and so that's what happened with the Irish people. Now, I'm going to use one more example, and just trying to paint a vivid picture to give you examples, you know, of other people embracing nationalism due to the circumstances that they find themselves in collectively. And if you take white Jewish people or the segment of the European population around the world that has, carved out for themselves, you know, this thing called Judaism or Jewish, being Jewish. And, of course, you know, the way we've been taught in the Western, worldview, you know, we're familiar with the Holocaust and what what we're told about Hitler's plans or designs to wipe out the Jews, you see. And so in the late 19th century, the Jewish leadership under such individuals as Theodor Herzl developed a concept whereby the Jewish people, could have something on their own, something up there to protect not only their physical lives or their well-being, which we can sum up as anti-Semitism, you know, which is a term that has been carved out in particularly for white Jewish people who have been subject to various forms of attack. Okay, and so as a result of that, their leadership, developed the concept of what some of us understand as Zionism, you see. And so that was supposed to be an ideology to where, the Jews of the world could have some type of platform on which to stand and galvanize power, you see. And so being able to galvanize this power, they have been able to dictate their own future, you know, determine which direction they're going to go, how long it's going to take them, how fast they're going to get there, under whatever type of system of operation. And so this is where you see the power principle spread out in this system, varied system, economically, politically, militarily, even historically, having their story told, having the power to have their story told, you know, historically, through Hollywood, through being able to have the power in Hollywood to tell their own story, you see. And so all of that is the framework of what is referred to as Jewish nationalism. Now, personally, I've ran across a number of books or literature, whatever you want to call it, and I've read and seen things myself to where some of these, you know, Jewish pundits, these white Jewish pundits, have been so brutal in their language, have been so brutal in what Jewish nationalism should be, and it doesn't get put out, you know, across the various forms of media to where it can be subjected to attack or scrutiny or, you know, similar to what Dr. Khaled Abdul-Muhammad, who was formerly of the Nation of Islam, and at the time when he was the Nation of Islam, when he, you know, gave, you know, his speeches back in the 80s and the 90s, you see, and being brutal with his language, it came under attack because it was able to be put out into the, you know, public, you know, into the air with the public, because white Jewish people were able to control their power through media. And so as a result of that, you know, Dr. Khaled pretty much was expelled from the Nation of Islam, and then he went on to become the leader of the New Black Panther Party, after which, you know, those of us who understand and know better, we believe that it was assassination by poison. And but in the orthodox realm, or the general perception, is that Dr. Khaled Muhammad passed away due to an aneurysm. See, but the point again is to being able to be in control of the power, so you can you know, operate how you will, you know. And so Jewish nationalism has never been something in general where everybody is, you know, the average person hates it or complains about it or lambasted it as racist, as separatist, as all these other things that supposedly are un-American, you know, goes against the this great picture, this great perception of, you know, the great melting pot of America and how we're all together as Americans, you know, and that this was demonstrated in one of the best ways on 9/11, how we as Americans, we come together. And, you know, we're real strong once we come together. So we say on a smaller scale that black people should come together collectively and be strong and, you know, control our own destiny. And so we say that if nationalism was good for the Arab people in response to imperialism, then we say that that nationalism is also good for black people in response to similar here in this country under the system of capitalism. And if nationalism was good for the Irish-speaking people or that culture, then it's good for us. And if nobody complains about it, then nobody shouldn't be complaining when we say nationalism, because it's good for us. And, of course, you know, if nationalism can be embraced by the white Jewish people of the world under such thing as the World Jewish Congress. Then we say we can develop our own label or name or whatever you want to call it, and it's good for us. Now, Marcus Garvey, you know, whom we opened our first show up on, spoke on that. He spoke on that. And he clearly established, you know, the black nationalist ideology. And he was practical at doing it. He wasn't perfect, but he was consistent at it. And that's all that should matter to us. You know, so, you know, he was able to practice it. And he did a great job in terms of black people starting to be able to reclaim their humanity, their sanity, after, you know, several hundred years of a white psychological warfare, you know, in its various forms, you know, psychological and mental abuse. And, of course, you know, you see us here today, right here in America, referring to ourselves as niggas. You know, and now it's a term of endearment, you see. And so Marcus Garvey was able to establish that. After him, Malcolm X. You know, Malcolm X spoke about just nationalism. And, of course, he came up and rose through the ranks in the Nation of Islam in the 50s and the 60s during that time, which was, you know, headed by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And so, you know, developing the sense of self and pride and you know, and I mentioned last week that some of the concepts, you know, that Elijah Muhammad adapted from Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X, who we also know as Saint Omar Wiley, his father was a Garveyite, you know. So Malcolm, you know, we can say, kept it alive or revived it after the death of Marcus Garvey. And on the heels of, you know, of that and in contemporary at the same time was Kwame Ture. This is the elder who was formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, who was a member of SNCC, which at the time was known as the Student Nonviolent National Coordinating Committee. And it was that group that was formed and went into the rural areas of the South, you know, and began to organize the disenfranchised black people there, you know, to have a say-so in local politics. In other words, having somebody who looked like them, you know, in a seat in local government, you know. And so as a result of his work and another brother, another elder, man who just had the honor, you know, to be able to talk with my lifetime, formerly known as Willie Ricks, you know. And on one occasion when they were organizing, you know, they all were given specific roles, you know, to carry out, you know, and almost, you know, I almost say play, you know, but you be careful in some of these terminology and correct them, you know, we have to, but, and some people think it's being trivial, you know, but it's not. But, anyway, they had sent, Willie Ricks, you know, ahead of them. And, you know, he said that when he got there and he was, you know, talking to the people, and he started talking to the people in terms of language that they can recognize and understand, and you know, it occurred to him about the power, and then he thought about the people that he was talking to, they were black. And he said he just started saying black power. And this is the first time, you know, at least on record, you know, that we know of, that this slogan was told to the people. And so, you know, he said that as he kept saying black power, he said he can see the, you know, the excitement in the people that he light and fuse underneath the people. So he said he went back, you know, to the camp, so to speak, and, you know, informed, you know, Stokely Carmichael, you know, of this thing about black power. And he said he had described it to him. And he said that Stokely Carmichael looked at him and thought he was crazy. You know, like, you know, he, you know, he just didn't believe him. You know, he, you know, he just, it was just like too good to, you know, to be true. And, you know, he said, okay, yeah, you know, so when he got there, and he went to saying, you know, and he started responding to people. And so Stokely Carmichael picked up the slogan black power. This is a man who popularized the slogan black power. You know, and he took it around the country, and it was heard around the world. And that slogan by itself became a problem for two reasons. He was saying black, and he was talking about power. And that's why it became a problem. So therefore, he became a problem. And I'm not talking about just the average white person in the rural South, you know, who were being called honky. You know, we're talking about people in power positions, the ones who steer the state, the ones who can, who operate the state, the proprietors of the state, the, you know, the shareholders, the stockholders, the stakeholders, you know, the corporations and the companies, you know, not just some mayor or Governor Wallace standing in the door of the high school, you know, refusing to let, you know, the first black person into the school. We're talking about people who have the power, who had the power. And so they realized that this man had begun to think like them. And he had went beyond this civil thing, you know, the civil rights thing. You know, the civil rights thing was just a plank of the whole structure and idea of black power. It was not the whole ball game, as we have been led to believe and projected onto us, you know, by the various forms of media historically. And so when he began to go around the country, at some point, the FBI, under the leadership of J. Edgar Hoover, put out a memo and stated that there must be prevented the rise of a black messiah. And he named certain individuals. And one of these individuals was Stokely Carmichael. And I mentioned somewhere along those lines last week, you know. And so it was only fitting that they would look at him in the way that they hadn't looked at other leadership back then. And so the group that he was part of, you know, SNCC, you know, had his different presidents. And another one of these presidents, leaders or chairmen or whatever was known back then as H.Rap Brown, you know, who is currently being held as a political prisoner due to his political views, which were contradictory to the state, which were antagonistic to the state. You know, and so he began to understand the same concept of power. You know, so it's a timeline that we're talking about here. And we must continue to push the ideology of black power for, you know, for various reasons. You see, you know, which would, you know, what we would, you know, could say, you know, on this radio show is a totality of black power. I had mentioned five things. And, you know, let me know what kind of, you know, we have any callers, you know what I'm saying? But I want to, you know, kind of cover what we're talking about here, you know what I'm saying? So we can, you know, just like really, you know, get into it, fully into it, and then, you know, we can get callers in. I mentioned something about
Black Power, if you want to participate in the show. Black Power, if you want to participate in the show, make sure you take and press 1. Black Power.
Okay, right on, right on. All right, yeah, you know, and we're not afraid, you know, to talk about spirituality. You know, all too many times, you know, groups such as ourselves, you know, who declare, you know, ourselves as revolutionaries, you know, in this image, you know, this public image, this social media image, you know, of black militant groups, you know, holding AR-15s and shotguns, and you know, with the combat boots, you know, and then, you know, and we're not afraid, you know, to speak or fear alien to talk about spirituality, because we've always been a spiritual people, and you know, historically and from where we from, we've never accomplished anything or had the level of success that we've had and we still have today without some form of spirituality. And so when we talk about spirituality, you know, we talk about the God in us as human beings first. You know what I'm saying? And that God that we know and understand from where we came from, our motherland, you know, you'd have the, you know, this belief that when the Arabs came first and turned us into slaves, you know, before the Christians. And I know, you know, when you speak in these religious terms, you know, Christians sort of get a sense of belief, you know, when you're talking about their treatment of black people, because they can put it on the Arabs first. You see what I'm saying? But anyway, you know, the Arab slave trade, and then the Christian, you know, slave trade. Okay. And this thing about that the Arabs had brought us, you know, the true and one and only living God, who they say has 99 names. Well, those of us who understand and know better, we know better to believe that the Arabs brought us anything when it came to the one and only true and living God, because we had always known who and what the one and only true and living God is, even by name. For instance, one of those names is Umkulum Kulu, he who does when no one else can. Not they who does when no one else can, he who does when no one else can. You see what I'm saying? And so we already knew that. And that was that been our foundation, our rock, baby naming ceremonies in particular. You see, there's a ritual that's carried out. For those of you who've seen the movie Roots, you know, they portray one of the, you know, one of the scenes in the movie Roots where I forget which baby was born. I don't know if it was a Kunta Kinte. I can't quite remember. But anyway, when the baby was born, you know, the father, you know, held the baby up to the sky. And so we point to a particular ritual where Alex Haley, who wrote the book Roots, was trying to show us in that movie how we had always been as a people, you know, in our homeland, you know, doing particular rituals that we were able to do, and then the success came. You know, the material, the sex, success, physical success, whatever you want to call it. Even in what the white man called ancient Egypt, and we're gonna use that for another example. But anyway, even you know, in ancient Egypt, when they were building these extraordinarily huge monuments, laying down the groundbreaking ceremony, you know, they went through these rituals. You know what I'm saying, when he pulled water, when he was establishing, you know, north, east, south, and west, whatever, stuff like that, and such an incredible knowledge and understanding of astronomy and how to place these monuments on an exact position on the earth in relation to some of these stars in the sky today, in the exact position as some of these stars or form when we see them at night, in particular what's known as the constellation of Orion. And there's these three stars that you look at, and they're not in a straight line. It's sort of like kind of off-kilter, like, so to speak. And those three stars in the sky were replicated on Earth by what's known as the three great pyramids that, you know, people all from all around the world go visit every year. And so in that groundbreaking ceremony, we pulled what now they call libation. You know, we went through these water rituals, these spiritual rituals before we even built the, the monument. So to say that we had laid the spiritual foundation down, and then we, you know, then the material success came out of that. You see what I'm saying? And so forth. You know, just one thing after the next. You know what I'm saying? And then Kemet, you know, going back and reclaiming a reclamation of ourselves on a spiritual level, in order to be to have success, in order to be able to achieve black power. You know what I'm saying? To where this doesn't end up in such a way to where it's chaos. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what we've always been as a people. But in Kemet, you know, and particularly using that as an example, they practiced what was referred to as Maya, something similar to that pronunciation. Whereas in hieroglyphic signs, the equivalent of four letters, which would be, you know, in the alphabet we know, is the letter M, the letter A, another A, and then what's referred to as the letter T. Now, this letter T has a particular meaning to it, the reason why the term ends in the T. And so by nature, you know, this T was feminine. And so we developed this concept called Maya. And this was the foundation in Kemet, you know, the spiritual foundation in Kemet, the way of life, you know. You know, these seven principles or whatever, you know, the number seven having its meaning, you see what I'm saying, in spiritual science. And so that was the foundation. And not only in Kemet, that's just some isolated phenomenon, but all throughout indigenous Africa, you know, and even today, you still see the same concept, which is the way of life, you know, in other parts of Africa. In other parts of Africa, it's called Maya, you know, M-Y-A, you know, Naya, N-Y-A, because the N and the M, you look at it, you see the relationship, Mia, M-I-A, Ma, you know, Maya, you know, M-A-I-A, M-A-A, you see. And so this, the way of life is still carried all around throughout indigenous Africa to this day. And This form of spiritual psychology is actually the root and the foundation of all the other religions today. And it was transported all around the world. You know, and so you have what nowadays called Islam, Christianity, so-called Judaism. And so, but you know, and the reason why I said it, because, you know, if this religion existed 4,000 years ago, it definitely couldn't have been called Judaism, because the letter J, you know, is pretty much like a virgin today. You see what I'm saying? So these different forms, you know, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism in China, you know, and the lesser known spiritual psychologies, Zoroastrianism, Manichaeism, you know, you know, and named that the individuals who came, you know, and these people who missed in existence, and taught them, you know, similar Confucianism. So Maya is a foundation principle of all other religions. And so that's part of the totality of establishing black power, black nationalism has been a foundation, has always been a foundation, was as a people. You see, anything beyond that will end up being madness and chaos. And this is what we have here in America today. And the state understands that, because the state cannot allow our children, us as a people, to actually collectively get back to embracing Maya as a principle, as an African spiritual psychological principle, because it does them no good. You see, it does them no good. So we wanted to start off with that, okay? I guess the next thing that we can speak on as far as this totality of black power is the political realm, a political context. You see what I'm saying? And so how does that play in the part of, you know, black power, you know, black nationalism? Well, you know, I sort of mentioned it somewhat when we were talking about what Willie Ricks and Stokely Carmichael was trying to establish. You know, so of course, you know, to be a nation of people, it is inevitable that we are going to have some type of political relationship or some type of political wranglings and whatever and stuff like that. So we how do we understand that to the best of our ability, you know, to exist with the power, the power in politics. You know, this whole thing about establishing local politics in the communities or whatever, which is, you know, what the Black Panther Party was about too, you know, one of the 10-point programs, you know what I'm saying? But yeah, you know, the political realm, of course, it can be really tricky, you know, but we understand that it has quick limitations, and these limitations don't extend as far as we would like them to be, or we are led to believe, especially by what we are going to refer to as the Negro bourgeoisie, the Negro class that Malcolm X had talked about. You know what I'm saying? But just being able to be in control of our own destiny politically, if we are going to be living in these communities, and not just that, but of course, it's useless without economics. You know what I'm saying? But just the political affairs, you know, to be in control of our own political affairs in the areas of the neighborhoods where we at. Now, let's not get it twisted. Huey P. Newton said, National Minister of the Black Panther Party, he said that, you know, these survival programs, you know, these immediate successes, these temporary fixes, you know, pending revolution, you know. And so when you say power, you mean the power in place in the hands of the people, you know, the political power, you know. And so therefore, naturally, there would have to be some type of confrontation with the state, which is historic. And, you know, we're not going to shun that. But it's a historical reality when you talk about politics. Other than that, that politics is a low down dirty game that some of us have renamed as politics. You know, whether they're Democrat or Republican. You know, we understand that a jackass looks different from an elephant, but we also understand that the power, the purpose controls, you know, both of those parties. You know, which is why you've had attempts of individuals come along and start, you know, these third parties, independent parties, whatever. Not that they're terribly misguided, but understanding, you know, that they want to come out from under both parties and establish a people's party. You know, so therefore, we understand on the larger scale as being a people's political party in a much more varied way, you know. And, of course, when we talk about politics, you know, the political power, then, of course, we have to enter the discussion or the topic of under which type of system. You know, as we know today, being under the present system, capitalism has been nothing but a failure, has been nothing but a nightmare, regardless, contrary to them, you know, selecting a few of us, and, you know, allowing them to make history. I've learned to understand and say that in desperate hours, America will pull out some of her best cards, you know, that she's had up her sleeve to try and keep the most depressed, oppressed, and repressed people in this country, you know. Along with, you know, the brown man and the red man. We understand that this attempt is going to be made to try and press upon us that we somehow have come a long way politically, especially with women, trying to get black women to understand that they've made these incredible strides. You don't have to tell them that, you know. But there's these subtle attempts to beguile black women into thinking, you know, that the future looks bright, And now it looks really bright. The Europeans are toot-ka-toot, whether it was a Republican or a Democrat. And so it's no coincidence that first they selected a when she wanted to be black president. And then following that, selecting a black female judge. I don't believe that it's a coincidence that she was selected particularly. I had said, after I seen the list, I said that he's going to choose the one with the African sounding name and the one with the African looking hair. Even though he knows deep down inside in his subconscious and his psyche. And this may be something that may be troubling to particularly the sisters. It's not personal, it's political. But in his subconscious and his psyche, it's no coincidence that he selected her and she has a white husband. Because psychologically, in this level of thinking, the way the European man thinks sexually, his obsession with these sexual dysfunctionalisms in his mind, he still says, yes, I have selected somebody who I still own. I have selected somebody who still belongs to me. You see, which extends back to the same type of white pathology that, was running rampant doing slavery. You see, so it's bigger than just, hurt. But again, we know better in believing that the political system in which we are held hostage and bondage today is capitalism, and we can't go nowhere on the earth and find any people anywhere, black and brown people in particular, anywhere, having a good time under the system of capitalism. It's just that you can take, again, and take a few people, whether we're here in America, South America, Africa, and use these various forms of media to make us think that we've arrived and that capitalism, under capitalism, we're sitting ducks without it, that we couldn't make it without the beautiful system of capitalism, and that all the other isms are oppressive, communism, socialism, and all the other isms. Where we can look back to Africa and those of us understand that know better that we're just not somehow kind of way we're sitting in Africa just twiddling our thumbs and didn't have no type of political system under which to operate. And there's a term as of this day, which is thousands of years old. As a matter of fact, there's a tribal group, a collective group of nations known as the Bantu. And this term itself, the Mbuntu, Mbantu, means the people. And it has these various extension words, which means the clan, the community, unity. So we've always had an idea of a type of system under which we could operate collectively as a people. And we know that as today, all the science and technology that we are confronted with, one thing about America and one thing about the capitalists, they are good at producing things. They are good at producing what is referred to as consumer goods. They are good at that. In fact, that is their civilization. That is their civilization. It's what they can create and make using science and technology, which is their civilization. But the last time I checked, the first five letters in the word civilization is civil, some type of civil codes under which a people could live in cohesion and in peace and togetherness, and, of course, equality. But we know that it's been nothing but a failure here, and we understand it. So that's why we say that capitalism must go. It must go. And we have to reclaim our humanity in the aftermath of it. You see, and so, yes, in the political realm, for those of you who vote, take part in the local politics, state politics, federal politics, understand again that this voting thing has very quick immediate limitations. unless the individuals that you are voting on come from where you come from, walk like you walk, talk like you talk, you know, be like you be, hang out where you hang out. Now, there are those who are listening. There are those who understand what I'm saying. And so, yes, what do they say? Well, shit, yeah, put on a Tupac T-shirt. You know, and whatever the latest teams, you know, that's winning the Super Bowl or the NBA title or whatever, and the latest pair of kicks, go out and give me a pair of those kicks that the youth wearing now, and show up at the nightclub, show up at the school dance, do a little pop up at whatever, you know, to win the people over, especially in the church, you know. And so they understand these types of things, and this is the strategy, tactics of a capitalist. This is what a capitalist does, you know. Profit motive, you know, and free enterprise, you know. That's his religion. That's his Bible, you know. But whatever it is, we know that our answer to our success and being able to have power as black people is not capitalism. It is the antithesis of black people's existence, you know, since day one. You know, 500-600 years ago, you know. But again, yeah, you know, we wish you well. Not say wish you, but you know, your attempts to develop and control local politics within your community. You know, it's a temporary fix. You see, the next thing we want to talk about. Let's get back to. Sort of a historical perspective, historical perspective as far as black power goes, you know, to be able to have the power to tell your own story, your own history, you know, like I mentioned about white Jewish people have the power to control and you know, how they are viewed through the various forms of media, whether it's a blockbuster movie, you know, as opposed to always being portrayed as a pimp, a prostitute, a step and fetch it, a buffoon, you know, a comedian, you know, a jackass, a big 280-pound man, you know, full of muscles, you know, with the mind of a child, or to be put in a commercial over 300 pounds, you know, damn near 7 feet tall and in a commercial and about to play a pickup game with some children, and the child selects broccoli. And people can't even see that. It's this image. It's this image. So to be able to be in control of our own history, to tell our own history, our true history as a people, you know, and one of these accomplishments is what's known as the ancient Egyptians. And I mentioned that, you know, just to go into that right quick, the attacks. The attacks on whether or not the ancient Egyptians was black or not, you know, and how the Europeans having the power of media, various forms of media, to control how the Egyptians is being spun to the public, okay? You know, internationally, where they established the so-called science of Egyptology in the major universities, and this obsession with ancient Egypt, you see. And so if we had the power to control these same institutions or develop our own institutions under the concept of black power, we'd be able to put it back into its proper perspective, which was a black perspective, which was a natural perspective from nature, from genetics and everything else, and the environment, you see. Unto this day, these Egyptologists, these anthropologists who examine the skulls, the skeletal remains of the so-called Egyptians, you know, who lived 5,000-6,000 years ago, and controlling the narrative of what the Egyptians looked like physically. And so at first, due to the treatment of black people during the slave trade, the Europeans, in order to justify their treatment of these Africans, had the first wipe the Africans' history slate clean, their accomplishments, and then replace it with words such as savage, pagan, primitive, uncouth, and worst of all, cannibal, in order to justify their treatment of black people and spun to the international public, you know, under those denigrating terms. And so it was no way that the Egyptians who built those pyramids could have ever have been black. No savages, no uncouth persons, no uncivilized, no primitives would have had the intellectual capability to build those pyramids based on the stars in the sky. And so therefore the Egyptians were white. And at one point, the standard history textbook in America, and some of and our grandmothers, some of us, our mothers and grandmothers, were taught about this world in world history, world civilization. And the person who they put in charge of putting that book together was one James Henry Breasted. And in that book, when he talked about the ancient civilizations of the so-called Near East or the Middle East or the Middle Eastern Crescent, James Henry Breasted, when he was listing the ancient civilizations of the whites, he placed the Egyptians as belonging to his made-up racial group called the Great White Race, and that to explain those dark brown skin complexion that you see in those still colorful paintings inside those temples and monuments, to explain the color, their color, the skin color that they gave themselves, to explain that away, they simply had suntans. They was just dark-skinned white people. But when that began to fall apart, it could no longer hold any weight. They changed the narrative and said, okay, yeah, they were Africans, but they were not Negroes. They were Africans, but they were not Negroes. They were Hamites, but they were not Negroes. They were anything except not Negroes. And then when that could no longer hold weight and they had to change it, say, okay, well, okay, yes, some of them were Negroes. And then some of them were mixed. And then some of them, yes, were pale skins too. And so did they. Present Egyptological stance is that the ancient Egyptian population was an amalgam of all different types of people. All the different races was there, and they were mixed people. And so that is what power does when it comes to history. And of course, we know history is tied in with the school system, the institutions. You know, to control the institution, you can institutionalize somebody, then you can control their mind. See, and so black power is very crucial in that perspective. In order to be able to control how our children are taught, this is what the Black Panther Party was about, in the 10-point program of being community controlled, therefore to control the schools, and therefore if you control the schools, then you can control the curriculum. White Jewish people can write history books about themselves. As I said earlier, they can make movies about themselves, documentaries about themselves, because they have the power to do so. Okay, and so black people should be able to have that same power to tell their own history. And not only were the Egyptians were black, but all the civilizations in that time frame and that period, in what they call the Middle East, whether it was in ancient Babylonia, you know, or ancient India, these lesser-known civilizations, because more people, more times than not, know about the Egyptian civilization. But they had other civilizations, the Nubian civilization, which was south of what they call Egypt. You know, a civilization in Palestine, a civilization in Syria, a civilization of what now today they call Turkey, formerly known as Anatolia, a civilization in Iraq, a civilization in Iran, a civilization in India, and yes, as far as China, that whole contiguous region together, all those civilizations were built by black people, whom the Greeks from Western Europe or from West Asia, let me get that right, from what is now known as West Asia to India, The Greeks referred to that whole region as Ethiopia. The Greeks said that they had two Ethiopias, an Asiatic Ethiopia and an African Ethiopia, and that they were sundered in twain, the ones in the east from the west. That means the ones who were out farthest to the east, they were where the sun rose. And there was also Ethiopians where the sun set. And then you cross the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, and then there was another group of Ethiopians referred to as the Western Ethiopians. And so this is what Black Power is, to be able to teach our children not only just these accomplishments here in America every year during Black History Month, when the corporations and the companies take over in the interest of white, in the interest of what? Capitalism and the state and white supremacy. In order to do what? To keep softening Black people, to keep Black people in the conditions that they're in, a condition of lethargicness, a condition of passiveness, a condition of integration, not seeing color, none of that. None of it. While at the same time, the Europeans are practicing white power in way much more sophisticated ways. They've long given up the robe and the hood. They've long given that up. These fringe white groups who still want to wear their little whatever, white sheets over their faces or whatever, they're pawns. They're being used. They're the first line of defense. And the other whites can claim that they're not like them. You know, the politicians. But Donald Trump was just being himself when he said there were good people on both sides. And how could you be mad at him? He was just telling the truth. Donald Trump, Joe Biden, George Bush, Bill Clinton, whoever you want to call us, Obama, whatever you want to call us.
Different names.
Yeah, right on. There you go. So that's pretty much what that is. But that's an example from a historical perspective to be able to tell our true history and, of course, being the original people on the planet. What they now call Europe was populated by people who look just like us here in America today. They had, and I like to say it like this. I love to say it like this because it doesn't bother me. Yeah, the people that lived in Europe, they had big-ass noses and them big-ass lips, too. That's right. We had them. They had them there, too. And they found human skeletons all throughout Europe. Some of them 700,000 years old had those features. And this is what we mean by Black Power. Now, some people, there were those who don't know any better. There are those who are part of the system. That those who have fell for the okey-doke, right, you know, go along with this white disinformation campaign as black supremacy, you know. And, of course, that's a knee-jerk response to our counter-move in chess as opposed to the move that they've made on us, which forced us to make our move. And that's Black Power from that perspective. Okay, now, two more. And of course, you know, culturally, you know, we, you know, sort of talked about that, you know what I'm saying, embracing one's culture, being proud of our physical features, our hair, our nose, our lips, our skin complexions, or what have you, even our flat feet, our whole physicality. And there are those from a biblical perspective that said that Adam and Eve was the first two people on earth, that God made him in his own image, and that we know that through medicine and science, we know that if there was an Adam, then we know that Adam couldn't have been but anything but black. I mean, anything but white. We know that Adam had to have been black. So if God made Adam in his own image, then what does that say about God? And so from there, being the original people on the earth, you know, so there's nothing wrong with that at all, period. But to embrace where we come from, Africa. I claim Africa. You know, the richest continent on the earth. And, of course, due to the capitalist system of imperialism and neocolonialism, it's the richest continent on the earth, but it has the poorest people on earth. And that is a complete contradiction. And in no way, shape, or form that we can rationalize that, regardless of what they try to say, regardless of how they try to say it, it's the Africans' own fault. And we know that to be a lie, but they embrace who we are as a people. You know, that those of us in this country who have embraced it, we've given Whitey back his name. You know, giving him back his poisonous food. Some of us are still struggling with it. And you keep struggling and struggling and keep struggling. You're going to keep on saying it and keep on struggling and keep on saying, like Chairman Fred talks, that I am a revolutionary. Now, the last thing we speak of, all these things that we could have, we can get more into the economic. Let's get into the economics, and then we can cover the last one. But yeah, economically also, we know that no people can survive without some type of economic prosperity in any community, regardless of the color. But in Black people's case, you know, particularly learning and understanding the importance of economic infrastructure in our communities and our neighborhoods in order to simply be able to survive. Now, this has been talked about, has been time and again through these various concepts of buy Black, support Black entrepreneurs, these different types of things. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it has to be some reciprocity, because Black capitalism is just as dangerous as white capitalism. It's just as dangerous. Hell, Black people have supported several individuals who we are told today are billionaires. And so we wonder or are curious as to whether or not these several individuals have made a huge, strong impact among the Black communities of America, which is now which has been under attack through a legalized form of reinstituting a form of slavery and segregation known as gentrification. And the displacement of one group into another group, which creates territorial factionalism. And so therefore we know that crime and politics go hand in glove. One is not inseparable from the other, because one can't do without the other unless the capitalist, the ones who push it, is in trouble. Unless capitalism implodes on itself, or that crime turns and becomes revolutionary in a sense, okay, which some refer to as revolutionary violence, you see, and become conscious of itself, and they are able to understand the people who have put them in the predicament that they have been put in order to annihilate one another. You see, and so the first thing that they had to do was remove the economics from out of the community. And of course, Malcolm X tried to get us to understand this. There are certain brothers and sisters who came out of that will still say to this day that the minute we integrated was the minute that we started losing our Black businesses, these former Black communities where they were Black-owned businesses and what have you, you see. And so that's why some of us understand that integration was a quote-unquote mistake, you see. And so, yes, economics is very important, and we must have it. And so in order to be able to figure it out and devise it, but we know there's other factors under this system that we're forced even have exorbitant prices among our own, because of these various things they put in place to keep themselves in the proper position when it comes to buying material resources. For instance, let's say somebody who wants to open up a t-shirt shop, you know, he must get the t-shirts, he must be able to get the ink, he has to buy the machine, he has to do all these things. And so we know that those who set the prices on these materials that we need can set these prices how they want them. And so therefore we'd be forced to sell our t-shirts for $30 because they've raised the price on ink. So this is what capitalism does, and this is what we know. So Black economics will be just as dangerous as white economics if the system itself is not removed and want a more humanist system put in place to where people can be able to thrive in their communities without being worried about being terrorized by the pigs or these outside imposing forces that come in and turn our communities into drug zones and areas of violence where Black women become the most exploited. in the system such as that. Now, this last one, of course, in order to be able to have all these different things, to be successful, whatnot, then there's no nation that has set up anything, or no group of people that has set up all these wonderful things and didn't have anything to protect. And so we believe that in the system of black power, where people can have the power, that the people also had the power to protect themselves the best way they see fit in an organized manner, in what referred to as militarism, in a military sense. And we understand, those of us, you know, who are politically conscious, we understand that people army is necessary. And so therefore, we see a lot of military potential out on the streets, you know, in this wanton savagery that has been used, the black movement, the black liberation struggle from progressing and to reaching its goal. And so therefore, violence is necessary. Black on black violence is a necessary tool to prevent revolutionary change, transformation of this system, of this country. You know, but Marcus Garvey, taught us that in order to be able to have an economic system, a political system, and being proud of your culture and history where you come from, and to have something to protect all that with, yes, you should have your military too. As a matter of fact, nobody understands that better than America. America has its military all around the world, everywhere you look. And so they're in no position to tell other people, in particular black and brown people, about not having their own military. Now, some can say, well, Brother Nat, I hear and understand. He said, okay, well, what land are you talking about here? You know, what land are you talking about? Well, the revolutionary transformation of society, you know, where the people could have the power, the people could take over the power, you know, and the people could live. Listen, it's a normal thing for groups to live in the communities that they live in. You understand what I'm saying? And I know we're getting, you know, on that time. But I want to ask, do we have any callers, Conrad?
We have callers, but nobody joined in the queue just yet. Like Paula.
Okay, cool. All right, right. Just let me know. But yeah, so, Marcus Garvey spoke about that. You know, to be able to have something, you need to protect your own. Now, of course, this tool, you know, with science today and how the Europeans have used science keep themselves safe, so to speak, on all fronts, on all levels. You know, they've taken science and applied science to the military. See, so much so that this science now has gotten them the ability to be able to use what's called microwave energy, energy that you can't see, but energy you can definitely feel, that could potentially fry your brains, that could potentially, cause a aneurysm, nosebleed, you know, things of that nature. And these are exercises for urban preparedness, you know, that this government uses, to simulate what they refer to as a civil disturbance, you know, in cahoots with the military, you know. And so there's no problem there when it comes to America to be able to have the world's most sophisticated, advanced, so-called military in the history of humanity. Now, there's really no way that they can prove that. You understand what I'm saying? But, you know, due to their elevation from barbarism to what they refer to as civilization, and along the way, their trials and tribulations, experimenting with all types of different things until they perfected the laser. In the meantime, we were prepped for that. We were, our minds were conditioned into the future with these futuristic movies that they made, and particularly the Star Wars movies, where they can show, you know, instead of a bullet being shot out of a gun, that the weapon can shoot out a laser. Okay, and so this is the type of military science that they're practicing, you know, to do what? To protect their assets, not only here in America, their holdings, but all around the world, all across the globe, the militarization of the police, which is what we're at today. And therefore, there's also referring to the state that, you know, that we live in a military state, and that in the type of language that we use, that the pigs is the arm of the state, and the Black Panther Party, they popularized it because they were politically correct, because they understood it. They put the police in the proper perspective in this relationship with the displaced, with the disenfranchised, from the plantation where the slave driver, you know, was on a horse with the shotgun. And so they traded in a horse for a cruiser. But they still have the shotgun in way much more sophisticated terms. You see, and so that is a form of militarism that is necessary for this country to maintain itself. So any other country who decides to think like America, develop the same type of ideology or thought process to be self-determined, must have its own military too. And there's a saying that's been around where it says, big bank takes little bank. Dog eat dog. And this is why you have some of these city codes, or there's been these successes against the major supermarkets, and particularly Walmart, okay, which, you know, goes around not only in America, but around the world, and tries to establish itself. And so therefore, there's these particular codes and mandates that are supposed to be designed to protect the mom and pop stores. You see, and that is what the system of capitalism does, protect their holdings around the world, which is what you see, you know, which is connected to the thing in Ukraine today. You know, so, but that's for another time. But in Africa in particular, you know, this scouring the earth for resources. And so Garvey said that if, you know, the gold was good for the Rothschild who financed Cecil Rhodes in the beginning in South Africa, then that gold is good for Africans. If the oil was good for the Rockefeller family, then that oil was good for the Africans. And if the diamonds is good for the Oppenheimers and all the other Jewish / Anglo-Saxon groups, then it was good. Then it was good for Africa. So therefore, that's what we mean on an international scale by Black Power, referred to as Pan-Africanism. Now, some may consider the other countries Arabic-speaking countries who are not necessarily viewed as white. In particularly Libya, for example, under Muammar Gaddafi, who had scoped out the Europeans' game, who understood it. And so Gaddafi was practicing what? Arab nationalism. And he had figured it out. He had figured out how to come up from underneath the yoke of the Anglo-American establishment, and was able to establish something for Libya. Now, Gaddafi has a book that he wrote years ago. It's called The Green Book. And inside this green book, Gaddafi talks about the world revolution, which is what Malcolm X was talking about, where he took the black struggle, the black predicament, the black troubles of America, and he placed them on an international scale, and which is what the Black Panther Party followed in his footsteps. But in this book Gaddafi writes about, called The Green Book, and he speaks about the world revolution, and he felt, in his opinion, in his humble view, from how he understood the world, that it would be the black man that would pull it off, that it would be the black man who would take the lead in it. This is in the Green Book. Don't take my word for it. Try to find a copy, grab a hold of it, and read it if you will. Read it if you dare. You know? And so, again, you know, black power is necessary for black people. Wherever we at on this earth, you know, in an expanded view of the terminology black, we should understand and transform our thinking beyond this concept of what the European has placed on the word black. You know, this particular definition for black people, which is a divisive tactic from the other international black and brown nations of the earth, and using such thing as head texture to define black people, the Negro, and then get the Negro to internalize himself as a Negro. So therefore, he internalizes the white man, then he internalizes the problem that he will face when he come in contact with other black groups on earth who have been dominated by the capitalists, the international venture capitalists, you know, that have been gone all over the earth. At present, we talk about the black people in Yemen. And we say black power to the black people in Yemen, even though they don't speak English. You know, so we know better. This is chess, is not checkers. And so we have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And but here in America, we say, yeah, black power is black people because we need it. And it's not a want. It's not something or some privilege. It's not some alien thing. It is not some irrational, illogical thought that the Negro bourgeoisie and even some of the black petty bourgeoisie would call themselves trying to debate or depose, being allowed access to media platforms such as CNN, Fox, MSNBC, even Newsmax, where they'd have access to scholarly journals, access to having their books published, access to a magazine, even Essence magazine, Black Enterprise magazine, Jet magazine, and all the rest of them. Some of us may be shocked at me using these names, but it is what it is, having access to a media platform that can go all around the country. So we know better, those of us who consider ourselves to be politically conscious, and the People's Political Party is just one of those groups of many who make this claim and therefore have to stand on it, you know, as a revolutionary organization. And I will understand that. If contradiction does arise, it is not the contradiction itself. It's how we deal with the contradiction, which is what Fred Hampton, Chairman Fred, tried to teach us, or did teach us, some of us, you know. But black power, again, is necessary. Anytime another group of people impose its ways on you, then there's a natural response for black people to react in a way that sets them in an antagonistic relationship with those who have created the condition. So therefore, it is only rational, you know, that we're able to respond in such a way that would pit us against those who seek to impose their will upon us and seek to continue to impose their will on us using various mechanisms, strategies, shenanigans, the police, the dope trade, the outsourcing of what they refer to as jobs, control of the job market. And of course, as a result of that, there is what appears to be black on black crime, black on black violence, and therefore self-imposed genocide. And so we want to stop right here and hope I've done at least a good enough job to discover, I mean, to go over the, you know, the five things, you know, that we've talked about here. And so on that note, you know, brother, you want to take us out of any movie, I mean, any music, any movie, but, give us a parting shot, you know, and remind, you know, those who listen to the radio show, you know, that we will be black next week. You know what I'm saying? I'm Brother Nat Turner, you know, the National Chairman of People's Political Party, the host of In Defense of the People's Radio, and I say black power and all power to the people. Brother, you got us?
Gotcha, Chairman. Black power, same black time, same black radio station. In Defense of the People Radio, every Tuesday, 7 o'clock Central, 8 o'clock Eastern. Black power, black power, black power.
The whole liberation of oppressed people in the United States has to do not with climbing up some ladder to success, not for asking to be just like Rockefeller or just like DuPont or just like Ford, because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people, and I began to see that the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people all over this world. The priorities of this planet have to be completely changed. And instead of profits, instead of policies that destroy the earth, that destroy the water, that destroy human beings, I believe a policy that protects people, that makes people live in a community, a world community, that's what I believe. That's my basic political commitment.
Spot where we can kick it, spot where we belong, that's just for us. This ain't gotta get all dressed up and be Hollywood. Nah, I mean, where the f*** go when we die? Ain't no heaven for a thug. That's why we go to Thug Mansion. That's the only place where thugs getting free, and you gotta be a G at Thug Mansion. A place to spend my quiet night, time to unwind, so much pressure in this life of mine. I cried times I once contemplated. And with a tribe, but when I held that, all I could see was my mama's eyes. No one knows my struggle, they only see the trouble. Not knowing it's hard to carry on when no one loves you. Picture me inside the misery of poverty. No man alive has ever witnessed struggles I survived. Praying hard for better days, promise to hold on. Me and my dogs ain't have a choice but to roll on. We found a finally spot to kick it, where we could drink liquor and know what bickers over tricks. A spot where we can peace. And even though we G's, we still visualize places that we can roll a piece. And in my mind's eye, I see this place, the players going fast. I got a spot for us all, so we can ball at Thug Mansion.
Every corner, every city, there's a place where life's a little bigger, little better
A place where death doesn't reside, just thugs who collide, not to start beef. No cops rolling by, no policemen, no homicide, no chalk in the streets, no reason for nobody's mama to cry. See, I'm a good guy, I'm trying to stick around for my daughter, but if I should die, I know all of my album supporter. This whole year's been crazy, ask the Holy Spirit to save me. Only difference from me and Ozzy Davis, gray hair maybe, cause I feel like my eyes saw too much suffering. I'm just 20 some odd years, I done lost my mother and I cry tears of joy. I know she smiles on a boy, I dream of you more. My love goes to Afeni Shakur, cause like Ann Jones, she raised the ghetto king in a war, and just for that alone she shouldn't feel no pain no more. Cause one day we'll all be together sipping heavenly champagne where angels soar with golden rings and Thug Mansion.
Every city, there's a place where life's a little easy, little Tennessee, we're back and cool every hour, cause it's all good.
Your baby boy's doing good. Tell the homies I'm in heaven and they ain't got hood. Seen a show with Marvin Gaye last night. It had me shook, dripping peppermint snot with Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke. Then some lady named Billie Holiday sang, sitting there kicking it with Malcolm till the day came. Little Sasha show grown. Tell a lady in the liquor store that she's forgiven, so come home. Maybe in time you understand, only God can save us. When Miles Davis cutting loose with the band, to think all the people that you knew in the past that passed on, they in heaven found peace at last. Picture a place that they exist together. There has to be a place better than this in heaven. So right before I sleep, dear God, wear the mask and remember this face. Save me a place in Thug's Mansion. Remember this face. Save me a place in Thug's Mansion. Up in Thug's Mansion.